morning, everyone. I thought we'd get started. It's a little after 9. May we have the safety note from Chief Safety Officer Lavin, please?
Good morning. This is a reminder to everyone, there are emergency exits on either side. You can go out those. In the case of an emergency, we're going to rally across the street at the museum. In addition, there's fire extinguishers strategically placed throughout the building. The nearest one, I believe, is behind me to the right. In addition to that, there's an automatic electronic defibrillator behind the guard at the center of the lobby. So this morning, safety contact is eyewear. In the United States, about 2,000 workplace eye injuries occur every day. Almost 70% of those accidents happen as a result of flying or falling objects. In most cases, the objects are smaller than the head of a pin. Most workplace eye injuries occur because safety wear is not worn as required. Many of those injured on the job either ignored this requirement or didn't think they needed to wear eye protective gear to do their job, or were wearing eyewear that didn't provide adequate protection. Recently, there was an employee injury. However, this individual will not be added to these statistics. Although the incident is currently under investigation, just this week an employee was performing a required inspection on a rail car when a filter canister malfunctioned, discharging contaminants and refrigerants under high pressure into the employee's face and upper body. Because he was wearing the appropriate personal protective equipment, including safety glasses, the employee suffered minor injuries to his upper torso, arm, and face. He was treated and released from the hospital without serious consequences. His required and approved safety eyewear did its job of preventing a potentially severe eye injury, which could have resulted in a permanent disability. Thank you, Ms. Kamati.
Thank you. Now I'd like to move the agenda, but I've been advised there is one last-minute correction on this, so I have to ask your approval of that. The correction is Ms. Jeter has an emergency and will not be here today to make her presentation on safety culture. Instead, there are two individuals, Mr. Esther Bilger, the Secretary-Treasurer, and the First Vice President, Carol Thomas, who would like to make a presentation on bus mirrors and blind spots. If we can make that substitution, we could move the agenda as corrected.
So moved.
Second. Second. Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Any noes? All right. Now I'd like to have a motion to approve the minutes of June the 9th.
So moved.
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. As I said, we will first have the presentation about the blind spots and the bus safety. Next, Chief Safety Officer Lavin will provide an update of Metro's safety statistics for the second quarter of the year and tell us how Metro's performance is measuring up against established targets. Mr. Lavin will then provide a progress report on the Roadway Worker Protection Program, including information on training, actions taken to ensure compliance, as well as actions to address NTSB recommendations. Then we'll move to the red signal violations, and I've asked Mr. Lavin to start that with an oral briefing of the facts of the Glenmont incident, which was recent and serious. And he will follow that with the general briefing on red light violations, actions taken, and analyses made. Last, he will give us a verbal progress report on Metro's work to address NTSB recommendations coming out of the L'Enfant Plaza incident. So I will turn the floor over now to the two individuals from the union, Mr. Bilger and Mr. Thomas, if they're ready to proceed.
Good morning. My name is Carol Thomas. I'm the Board of Vice Presidents of Local 689. At this time, I'd like to give the opportunity to introduce Brian Sherlock. He's a safety specialist from the ATU.
Thank you all. We have an interesting opportunity ahead to further safety, and WMATA has been working very hard on this, and their efforts are much appreciated. This issue is about the blind spots in the left front corner of the buses that are typically used across the United States, North America. And you see here is an example of the problem. This happens to be in New York. And the important thing about this, there's a young lady whose leg is pinned under that front tire. And she survives, luckily. But this accident will happen again and again and again. It's roughly every week to 10 days. The statistics aren't very solid, so we have to give a range.
But the problem is that you see the direction the front tire is pointed. That's the direction the front of the bus is going to go, obviously. It's also the direction of the blind spot for the driver, formed by this very wide mirror and very wide pillar. And as you're going around a corner, that blind spot is directly in your path of travel, equivalent to having a legal page stretched out square in front of you as you go down the freeway in a straight line. This is as you go around on a corner. This one is 14 inches wide. Now, the important opportunity here is that this is the frame from that exact bus. It's tiny, and it's narrower than the space between your eyes, meaning that if it's oriented correctly, you're able to see with one eye or the other every available angle. When you stretch it out this way, as we do, it becomes a lethal hazard, but it can easily be eliminated. The designer of this bus, a guy named Ludwig Mueller, a real good guy actually, designed it to the APTA standard of 10 degrees per obstruction and didn't think about the consequences of that. It was just designing down to a price point and meeting his bogey, the APTA standard. But that's what results in this problem. But the good news is we can easily solve it. Now, what are operators told to do in order to eliminate this hazard or mitigate it? There are three elements. One is you make a square turn. You go out as far as possible before turning as hard as possible. And the idea is that you're going to be able to see people who are in the crosswalk to your left by being out there that far. The second element is going at walking speed. This video I took under my chin. This is King County Metro, but it's a very representative case. Matter of fact, this is considerably better than the WMATA buses where the mirror is mounted here. This mirror is one I designed and King County Metro adopted. It's completely below your sight lines. So if you go down to the corner of the, and click on that. So we're proceeding in a straight line at walking pace. Oh, there's a problem. Actually, there's not just one child. There's three. One in a stroller and what looks to be two families. And why did they stay locked into that blind spot that's only half as wide as WMATA's? And only one lane away. It's very close at hand. They stayed there because I did exactly what I was instructed. So, next. This gentleman here is our example for this. The next thing you're told to do, the third element, is the bob and weave. You're supposed to be weaving around in the seat on a fairly constant basis. And that's supposed to move the pillar around so you can see people behind it. This shows you that improved mirror. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to lean as far as possible once this gentleman gets behind the pillar. And you'll notice that I not only lean, but I crunch over the steering wheel because sitting low and forward to better imitate the shorter operators who repeatedly have these problems. This huge steering wheel impinges on your sternum, so you're limited in how much you can lean. But I lean and crunch over, so you'll see the camera go down. So if you could play that. So he gets behind the pillar, and now here comes the lean and crunch. But it's not sufficient to bring him out of just the pillar, much less a pillar and mirror. And we both go at walking speed. So he stays there until I stop, and then look what happens. Now that group is passed. You should be good to go, right? Maybe not. So that's 15 people hidden in both directions, crossing in both directions. Now, your ability to multitask and track these kinds of bogeys was studied by the military. How many blips can you see on a radar screen? It's called the rule of 7 plus or minus 2. That's how many little blips, the simplest things conceivable, you can track simultaneously. That's twice that number before you count all the cars, scanning your mirrors every 5 seconds, and all these other requirements that almost prevent you from looking out the window if you really do what you're instructed. But again, the opportunity here is to eliminate this, and it's really trivial. Ludwig Mueller, that good engineer I mentioned who designed the bus to the APTA standard, when he saw a video that was similar where I made a turn in a procurement test drive, again with a camera under my chin, the whole street we're turning to disappears behind the pillar and mirror. And he was just horrified. We talked about how to eliminate it. He came back 2 weeks later, and at manufacturer's cost, at the time of manufacture, it was $270 a bus to fix this. All you do is you strip away surplus fiberglass, window seals that are in themselves hazardous, and aluminum framing around the side window. It's really trivial. And I think WMATA's dedication to safety means we have a high chance that they'll take these issues seriously and adopt these inexpensive changes to reduce risk. Next slide. Now, this is a WMATA bus. This broke down outside of our offices on in Friendship Heights. Now, it is parked at the curb, so be aware that this slightly exaggerates the width of this in feet, the width of the obstruction at the curb. Now, this is from my seat at eye height. Next. Now, this is the slide you just saw, and the blind spot begins here, and it goes into the trees here beyond this building, so slightly underestimated here. Again, this is at the curb, so you could cut this down a little bit if you're further over. But this is your path and a left turn. It's a staggering scale of blind angle. Next. So this is a close-up. Now let's take more time to look at this than an operator would have as they approach a left turn, where they would be turning precisely into this angle. Do you see any pedestrians? Anybody? I'm sure someone does. Okay, next slide. There are five. There are five we can see. But notice most of this space is blocked. And the scale of it, look at the size of these people. They're a ways away. But as you turn a corner, the air brake delay, it's two-thirds of a second. The human response delay to an unexpected stimulus, together those add up to 2 seconds. If you're going very slowly, once you cross that midline, you're pretty much going to whack whoever's in that crosswalk. So these scales are actually very close at hand in time. So no problem, right? You got five people there that you can see. Who knows how many you can't? You have to just bob and weave, right? Well, let's see if that works. So not only are drivers physically constrained so that they can't lean far enough to overcome this scale of blind spot, look at the directions these folks are moving. Which way do you lean? If this gentleman is standing in for the blind spot and I lean this way and my pedestrian goes that way, they stay locked in. Every direction you could lean, there's someone you're going to keep in the blind spot. And God knows how many more are hidden in the majority of this, which is blocked off. So WMATA, to their credit, has tried to resolve this. It's my guess that the reason why this mount is high is an attempt to mitigate this. And so you have the low mount mirror and a high mount mirror, basically the same mirror just flipped upside down. The problem here is that unless you think about the sight lines and engineer in safety from the very beginning, you're going to have these kinds of problems. The mirror has been mounted too high in the low mount and too low in the high mount, placing it squarely in the driver's sight lines. Now, this is going to be a problem for the extremely short operator. This one is going to be a problem for the very tall operator. This is 95th percentile. This is roughly 5th percentile. But that's the specified range of operators. In between, it's not going to be quite as bad, but we don't need this problem at all. This is the recommended mirror set. The way this works is it shows from the horizon to the front wheel contact point. That's right there. And it shows all the blind spot you can't see out your side window. So it's completely effective as a rearview mirror, but it only extends 8 inches above the window opening. So this baseline for this top mirror is right here at the elevation of the base of the window. So the shortest operator can see over this. This is from just below my normal sight line, but you can see where the pedestrians are. And this offers extraordinary coverage. It's cheap, not a very good piece of hardware, but it does the job, and it saves lives. Now, New Flyer is the vendor for the procurement that WMATA is involved in right now. This is a picture of an engineering drawing they displayed at a conference on this issue. And this is the structural element in an improved front pillar. And kudos to New Flyer. They've tried to improve this. They've taken some of our suggestions and mitigated things like all of this aluminum structure here is for the side window. You don't need any of it, but they have made it smaller. In your car, you don't have a big aluminum frame that moves with the glass. You just have moving glass. That can be done here and eliminate all of this. Next slide. So in this drawing, I've taken this example from them, copied it, and just transferred the structural element, got rid of all of the claptrap that's unnecessary aluminum framing, and put a little slot in the frame element so the glass can travel in that. This is narrower than the space between your eyes. The blind spot is gone. And this is the same structural strength as the original. Now, there still could be complaints that removing anything, whether it's just fragile extruded aluminum or fiberglass, could make it a weaker frame. So just as an example, this is doubling up the frame. This is twice as strong and a little bit more than that. It's two of these frame elements. Again, just move the glass up and down like you do in any reasonably designed vehicle. And you have narrower obstruction than the space between your eyes. You don't run over pedestrians. Get the mirror out of the way, and we'll have a better day tomorrow. That's it. Any questions?
Any questions for the? Yes, Mr. Bulger.
Thanks, Madam Chairman. I used to be on this committee with Mr. Goldman. This issue came up over 2 years ago. We were told, the committee was told, it was fixed. Here we are back at a totally different frame concept with on mirrors. I don't know why we were told it was fixed 2 years ago.
Again, to give credit, the industry has not been used to examining these questions, and I don't get too far into the details of this, but it's understandable because the iBrain system fills in blanks. We all have significant size blind spots, and we could do a little trick here to show you your own blind spots. It's stunning. The brain fills in blanks. And that's what goes on when you sit in one of these things without taking examples like fatalities where you work the physics backwards and you decide what happens second by second by second. Or having a lot of neuroscience background, you just sit in one of these things and there's an acre of glass. And a lot of larger guys will sit there and they kind of move around. In a static sense, it looks like you can see. So I don't want to beat anybody up too bad for not getting it. But by the time we've provided in-depth analysis and we're willing to go into exact recreations of individual accidents to show how these things happen, offer solutions, I do get less patient with that. I think it's beyond time, as you've said. We need to take these things seriously. $270 versus the lives, I don't get it either. By the time we've explained it, it's really time to move forward.
Does that answer?
What's the management response from 2 years ago?
Well, I can't speak for 2 years ago because I've been here for 2 months and 2 weeks. But I can tell you this. It's my understanding, and I believe Jack Reek was here. He could jump in if I don't have the facts correct. But management has met with the ATU. They came up with a new design for a mirror, and that pilot has been implemented. There's a couple things that are not in that presentation that should probably be discussed, and I believe, Brian, we've met in New York, so I do know Brian. A lot of the issues which you have, which can be addressed with new car procurements, is when you look at that center pillar, it can create an obstruction, which is why when you make a turn, you do it at reduced speed. You are required to move back and forth And most of the fatalities I've investigated is generally due to overspeed on curves. Okay, so they're not, to some degree, compliant. That is not the, you know, the answer isn't just reduce speed. There's other things you can do. So from a structural design standpoint, if you do it from design coming up, you can put in perhaps a titanium pillar in the middle because you don't want to make the crashworthiness of the bus suffer either, or in a high-speed crash, now you're jeopardizing the operator. Now that has to be engineered in from design. One of the other things that Brian brings up is that there's a gasket that runs around the frame of the window. If you take that design and you curve the window and you set it with an epoxy, you could also reduce that surface. That's also something that needs to be done in design. There's also other strategies that we could look into, such as if you have, most cars today have collision avoidance monitoring, so that when you make a turn, you can detect the pedestrian. These are things that perhaps we have not looked deep enough into. These are things we looked into in New York and started implementing. So I'm sure that there are things we can do to improve safety in this area.
If I might respond, thank you. This is the frame element. We're not suggesting changing it. We could certainly double it up and make it twice as strong. I'd like that. But here's an example from the 1960s. It's the same kind of frame, no problem. They were called fishbowls, you can see why. And one more slide. This is from the 1930s. They were the same in the 20s. Same frame element. This is not technologically beyond us, and it doesn't take space-age materials. One more. This is the bus we should be buying. This is a European design. There's no problem. Where we have metal and fiberglass, they have glass. We just have to do it.
Other questions? Ms. Hutt?
So these are our buses, and am I correct that there are probably quite a few of these out in our jurisdictions? Because I think some of these are being purchased through the review of other contracts and determine, and I guess that's the first that I heard. And when we think of what the cost is or what the solution is, are we all willing to share those kinds of things so that we understand that we're solving a larger problem than what we have here?
Yeah. What I would suggest is that there's a variety of these pillars. They're all, you know, roughly of the dimensions I've shown you. Yours are a little worse than the examples I've given you because the mirror is up high. But the current procurement could be altered. New Flyer, the vendor, has paid multiple seven-figure claims because of the hazard that's built in. They have the solution here. I'd suggest a cooperative effort to change the current procurement to put in a safe pillar, move the mirrors, and the ATU is willing to cooperate and make that easier for WMATA, and we could solve this problem. We could have something as good as this. Hope that was responsive.
Thank you. Thank you. Anyone else? Yes.
Thank you. Just a question. You're talking about changing a procurement. This would be for new buses moving forward. This wouldn't be a modification on the equipment.
Normally, that would be an expensive proposition, but with New Flyer paying these $7 million claims, and as the awareness of this problem spreads, the number of those claims is going to rise, and usually the agency ends up paying roughly half. So I think both New Flyer and the agency have an interest in doing this at no cost. It's cheaper for them to make these tiny little modifications than it is to pay the inevitable prices. So I would urge that they that this be a no-cost improvement in the future, both WMATA and New Flyer.
So is there any downside to anything we've talked about here from
management's
perspective?
And I'd offer to speak in his behalf. As you glue in the window, as we're recommending, when you replace the window, these seals that are increasing the hazard allow you to do it in 10 minutes flat. They weren't thinking of safety. They were thinking of low cost. And so it does involve a little more bother to cut out the glass when it's glued in. And they use a silicon sealer. It's basically like tub caulk. But in the good side, passengers can't be ejected in an accident. That's why it's not even legal to use these kinds of seals in your car, because you don't want passengers ejected. And we have standees in transit vehicles. So, yeah, there'd be a little more bother changing the glass, but you don't toss people out in an accident, and you don't run them over as readily. Was that fair?
Mr. Goldman?
And Mr. Sherlock, the problem you're identifying, the blind spot problem, that's just for this new Flyer series of buses. Is that correct?
It's basically in all of the North American fleets except these older buses. So we need to adopt these European standards, and it's easy to do.
So in terms of the WMATA fleet, how many buses are we talking about?
I don't know the numbers in the fleet.
All right, well, we'll get that. In terms of making this $270 change that you're talking about, has any existing North American system adopted that change?
No.
But why
it's,
is that?
This is, it's sort of, it's safety culture. In Europe, they take safety much more seriously. I think they're, I don't want to go too far into the cultural elements and why that happens. But they really take these things seriously. If someone dies, they examine the cause, and they get back down to root cause. And if the driver can't see, it's not just blame the driver, full stop, repeat, and repeat, and repeat. They solve the problem. And so it's that safety culture. And I know Mr. Wiedefeld and others at WMATA are trying very, very hard, and kudos on them, for their attempts to improve safety culture. But that's really the core element here.
I assume you've made this presentation to a number of properties, transit across the country. What has been the reaction? Have any committed, even though they haven't made the change yet? Have any said that this is something we're getting ready to do?
It's been interesting. It's been taken seriously, but as far as someone really solving it, no, it hasn't been done yet. And that speaks to the safety culture across the country.
Thank you.
Yes, leave. Bye.
Yeah, I just wondered, you know, what consideration in the analysis that you've done, particularly with the cameras, have you made for the fisheye distortion and the field of view issues that come with using these cameras?
Excellent, excellent, excellent point. Yes, you have to be extremely cautious about the focal length of your lenses. Telephotos collapse depth, and wide-angle lenses extend depth. Now, they don't change angles. So what I've spoken to you about is angles of view, because you're spot on. The eye sees at roughly a 50-millimeter focal length, and that is an issue if we were talking about the distance that you see in these shots as opposed to the angle.
Are there any other questions for the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you all for your attention. I really appreciate it.
Now we'll move to Mr. Lavin for the safety, second quarter safety report.
Elevator escalator employees, as well as the Office of Administrative Staff,
number of, increase your experience is elevator escalator injuries with 12% increase. And as far as bus collisions, that's a 27% increase. On the rail side, the rail station injuries actually showed a 16% reduction. If anyone has any specific questions on that slide, we'll move on to the next. So there are three key drivers that drive our injury rates: of the earth ergonomics, non-preventable collisions, and crime-related incidents. I just want to point out that from an agency standpoint, we can be more proactive to safety. For example, there's a safety complaint that was brought to us at Greenbelt Guard. Your employees have concerns about offload trucks on a slope. So we sent safety out there with the operating performance. We identified that the issue they were having is that the containers that the materials were arriving in required manual offloading. We had to change that delivery system so they can now be manual offloading forklifts. So hopefully we actually prevented injuries in those types of analysis of potential accidents. Okay, as far as crime-related incidents specific to employees, those continue to contribute to injuries. Those injuries include stress-related injuries due to witnessing crime on the street, and assault-related injuries for employees by customers, specific to train operators and station managers, as well as arrest-related injuries, also on the part of our police force. That's pretty much what I have for the quarterly report. Unless anyone has any specific questions.
Yes, Ms. Porter.
I noticed that in the materials that you sent us, you noted that Metro Access had a customer injury rate that was up 77%, which is a pretty large increase. I know that those are fairly small numbers, but I wonder if you have actual numbers for that. And then looking at the materials, the charts that you gave us, it looks like there was a real spike of injuries in May 2016 for Metro Access passengers, and a large amount of it was other. And so I wonder, I don't know if you've got the numbers with you, if you could put actual numbers to those. I mean, their rates, and I know Metro Access has a lower number of passengers, but also you noted in the materials that some of those were people falling while alighting. And I was under the impression that if somebody had difficulty getting into and out of the vehicle, they were supposed to get some assistance from the driver. So I wonder if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
So what I'm showing for as far as Metro Access for those types of injuries, there was non-collision related injury, e.g. door-to-door slips and trips. There was 10 injuries. The primary cause of those incidents were the attendant, as they were attempting to get the passenger in and out of the vehicle. Apparently, there was some type of loss of control, but they were being assisted as the injury occurred.
So that was 10 people who were in that situation, did you say?
It says 10 injuries, yes.
Okay. If someone is being assisted in and out of the vehicle, they shouldn't be, like, dropping them.
Is this
something perhaps we should follow up on?
Yeah, I would tend to believe in... And this is only from my personal experience. My wife happens to be an occupational therapist.
Mm-hmm.
So when you transfer a patient, there are transfer strategies that you can do. And people maybe we need to look at what training they're receiving for transferring these individuals. And it might be something we can look at as an area of improvement.
I would appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes, Mr. Lobby.
Thank you. Just a couple of questions, sir. You've been here 2 months now. Are we measuring the right things here? Are we measuring, I know that we have injuries, but are we looking at near misses? Are we looking at incidents that may lead to injuries like trains that are offloaded, where we have crowding on platforms or crowding near escalators, things like that? Do you gather any of that information, Pat?
Yeah, from my previous experience, I think people confuse a close call reporting system with near miss investigation. Because a close call reporting system, you're waiting for incident to be brought to you and driven, whereas when you investigate an incident and something as significant as a signal overrun, which we're going to speak about in a few minutes, I don't think we're
truly harvesting all the information from those investigations to where it can bleed into other areas. So I don't believe we're doing the MS investigation to the level that it should be, and I recognize that.
Okay, and that's something you're working on?
It is.
Okay, good enough.
If I could just add, and also you're looking at in basically beefing up that staff that does that and the training of that whole effort.
Yeah, just to, I think I said at an earlier meeting a month ago, is that one of the holes that I identified in the safety department was lack of a dedicated investigation team. Since that time, I've been approved for 6 heads. I've actually selected a person to run that group. I don't want to release their name now because I don't have an official start date for that individual, but I'm hoping that once I have that dedicated accident investigation team, these are exactly the things that we can surface and address at the scale it needs to be done at.
We'll look forward to hearing more about that.
Mr. Smedberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Levin, I'm curious about the crime-related injuries. Specifically, it says in our more detailed document that the MTPD is expanding its efforts within its divisions. Are you directly responsible for that, or is that something separate from what you're engaged in?
Well, typically MTPD would operate independently.
Independently.
However, there are areas where we bleed over. For example, which I'll talk about in Glenmont, you could have an MTPD response where if we put those individuals in jeopardy, then we didn't perform properly. So those types of event would be analyzed.
And I assume they're operating under various federal or state standards as it relates to safety, or do they create their own?
I believe they would be operating under standard OSHA laws as everyone else.
Okay.
That's my understanding of it.
Thank you.
Pat, do you have any information about the increase in escalator accidents? There was a fairly large increase for customers being injured. Do we know if they were not operating at the time, or was there? Maybe you don't, but I'm just curious. Do you? Okay.
Let me just check my notes. To
okay.
See what I have, but I can speak about a specific event. So what I have is the primary cause of the escalator injuries or behaviors where customers are running up and down escalators leading to slip, trip, falls. Mm-hmm. I can tell you we identified one specific escalator failure where we have 3 older style escalators in the system that have some type of hydraulic braking system, and those we're looking to replace because they actually resulted in a couple of customer injuries about a week ago. So it is something that's on our radar we pay attention to.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, it's back to Mr. Lavin for a roadway worker protection briefing.
Okay, you can go to the next slide. Okay, as of June 2016, all RWP cardholders are in compliance ahead of the September 2016 deadline. A revised RWP standard operating procedure was implemented in July that ensures the priority and compliance of RWP. Any individuals that are out of compliance, badges are destroyed. Those without badges are not permitted on the roadway. Testing procedures are modified to reflect stricter consequences for failing. So if you take an RWP class, you fail the first time, you have to take 2 days off, you're allowed to use vacation time. If you take the class again and you fail a second time, you'll have to take 2 days off without pay. If you take the class a third time and you do not pass the class, then as management, we look to put you into a position where you not be required to have an RWP status. In addition to that, as an organization, we're starting to look more at, you know, do we need blanket RWP, or are there certain titles that require this so we can do this more effectively and more efficiently? Go to the next slide. Okay, as far as NTSB recommendation R08, this is one of the first things I started looking at when I got here. This technology basically requires that the roadway worker and the train both be aware of each other's presence. I've had my staff reach out to different properties that are using various technologies. As far as LA and SEPTA, they've both implemented these types of programs. I'm working with our engineering function because I cannot reach out directly to them because of procurement issues. So we're going to try to get these vendors on property to show us what their technology consist of. However, there are things that we can do in the immediate here and now, and one of those things is we've reduced the speed of trains to work areas from 35 miles an hour to 10 miles an hour, and also required a train to use the horn to alert employees of their presence. One of the other things I'm looking at is the use of a flashing yellow light, and that only, the intent of that is only to raise the conspicuity of the employees on the track to an approaching train operator. We actually received some different discs that we may be considering using. That is a pilot that we will have to set up in the future. And as I mentioned earlier, we've reached out to other properties and we've conducted surveys about the technology that they're using. That's what I have for RWP at the moment.
Mr. Dormjo.
I'd like to just ask a couple questions about the training regime. So I actually took the training several months ago, and let me just get my card out to prove it. So I've got the card here, and I passed just the level one. What I'd like to highlight is that I thought the trainers were excellent. I think there was a very good team of facilitators, and the training was quite extensive, and I've learned a lot from the training. And I've been through similar trainings in other transportation industries, mainly on the highway side, going through maintenance of traffic training, which is kind of a similar concept as you set up work zones on the highway. But I did have one concern, and that was around the evaluation process. When you come to the training, you're given a test, which I think is a good idea, you know, kind of a baselining of where you are. I was a little surprised on the difficulty of the test, because I think without even taking the training, and I'm not looking to, you know, pat myself on the back here, I think I passed the test without having taken the training. So that raised a question about whether or not, you know, that, you know, kind of pre-test evaluation was kind of calibrated correctly. I frankly thought a lot of the people taking the course would probably have passed the test as well, because they have more experience than I do, and they've been with the company longer than I have. And then I was really surprised when the post-training test was issued, because it was the same test, but just the questions were in a different order. So when I see that 100% compliance with this roadway protection training, I wonder whether or not we're getting the most out of our training process. So I'd recommend you take a look at the evaluation portion of that. But I would like to say that the trainers themselves did an excellent job. But maybe management needs to take a look at the evaluation, because if people are going into the class, you know, and they have an understanding, you know, that this is kind of a perfunctory exercise, I think we're really losing the benefit of, you know, this activity.
All right, we'll look into that.
Mr. Lobby.
A couple of questions. When you talk about roadway worker training, we're only talking about the folks on the ground, on the track. Are we talking about operators or dispatchers or any of the other groups involved?
Yeah, that would also include train operators. I think if anything, we're training too many people. Like, we're training storeroom people.
Okay.
So I think we're going over the top as opposed to under training.
But the train operators are also getting instructions on how to react with people doing maintenance work.
Right, because they would also be required in an emergency to block and clamp a switch, so they would have to be qualified.
And you talked about how you're reducing the speed through work zones from 35 to 10 miles per hour. Is that correct?
That's correct.
How do you enforce those speed restrictions? Do you do observations? Because I had heard reports of trains moving faster than they should potentially through areas where people are doing inspections and other things. How do you make sure that they actually follow those speed restrictions?
Well, the problem you're going to encounter is that if people don't report this or you get under-reporting, you're not going to identify those incidents sufficiently. So the way you attempt to combat that is you come up with robust efficiency testing programs. So one of the things that you can do is you can use, because this is the one thing this organization has, is great technology. So you can now look at your AIM system, and you could put out a work zone, and then you could see what speed those trains are traveling at. But what you need to do in order to make that effective is have formalized, institutionalized, measurable goals for efficiency testing that everybody understands is this is how the efficiency test is conducted. This is the consequence of failing that test. These are the goals that you need to meet each quarter, and those goals need to be measured. They need to be enforced. And then the key thing you take from that is you take your trend analysis and you identify where your problems are, and you either address that through discipline or training or any combination thereof.
So are you monitoring train speeds for the work zones on a regular basis, and are you addressing it with individual operators?
No, not. I don't believe it's being done sufficiently today. But what I did do is I got a lot of documentation from New York about the efficiency testing programs we have in place. I've shared those with the operating departments, and it's my understanding by the end of September they're supposed to be able to stand up a better efficiency testing program than they have now. Because I looked at what the efficiency tests, and I don't think it's sufficient to change the operational culture you have today.
Very good. Thanks.
Pat, your presentation was in terms of road worker protection for WMATA employees. I assume we have a lot of contract and contractor employees doing the work in safe tracks as well right now. What is the training for those people? Do they go through the same regimen of training, and is that training administered by your department?
That's correct. The safety department does the contractor training. They only receive a level one qualification. I actually had them go audit the training to make sure that it mirrors what the operations people are given, and I know they made tweaks to it so that each whether it's received by operations or safety, whoever delivers it, both trainings mirror each other. One of the other things going forward is we're moving to a computer-based training, so then you'll have clear, consistent training all the time for the refresher classes.
But is that training done by the contractor, or is that training done by the safety department?
What you'll have is you can have people where we train the trainer. There was four trainers that were kind of WMATA employees but not safe employees. There was four trainers involved. One of them, I was not satisfied with their performance. That person no longer does that function. The other three I had recertified, and I had their classes audited to make sure that they're delivering the training appropriately.
And do the contractors end up with the same RWP cards such as Mr. Domjo described?
I don't know if it's the exact card. There may be a distinguished so that it says contract.
Contractor.
So you can distinguish them from employees.
But they go through the same training and the same testing and post-testing evaluation as WMATA employees?
I believe that's correct.
And just a final question. In terms of the total workforce, do you have a sense of how much of the workforce on safe tracks now is WMATA employees as opposed to contractor employees?
Andy, can you answer that question?
Which way?
70-30 WMATA.
70-30 WMATA, okay. Thank you.
Just want to make sure.
I see no more questions, so let's move on to the red light violations, and starting with Glenmont, please.
Okay. So on July 5th, there was a signal violation at Glenmont, and I don't think red signal violation fully captures what occurred in that event. So at approximately 7:15 p.m., a train operator left the blockhouse. He got into the operating cab. Now, prior to leaving the station, there's several things that are supposed to occur. The operator is not supposed to close the train doors until he gets a LUNA signal on the leaving signal at a terminal. He's supposed to perform a radio check to verify that he has permission to leave the terminal once that signal is LUNA. That did not occur. The person's individual radio was put in a bag behind them in their personal bag,
and it was either turned down or turned off to the point where any transmission would have been inaudible. There's also a car-borne radio. That radio was turned down as well. The train operator shut down the train doors. He left the station on a red signal, and he violated the red signal. He continued going. The switch at the opposite end of the diamond crossover, or the switch is at the opposite end of the interlocking. That switch was not in his favor. He trailed through that switch. In addition to that, there was two roadway workers a few feet south of that. He went past them. They cleared up on a bench wall to avoid the being struck by the train. They began to yell at him as he went by. He stopped approximately 300 feet beyond their position. At that time, there was another train that had left Wheaton heading towards him. The rail control center was on a radio making transmissions. That stopped the what I'm going to call a northbound train out of Wheaton. That stopped that train. That train would have also been stopped by losing speed commands as he encroached upon his position. When both trains came to rest, they were approximately 2,000 feet apart. At that point, the train operator turned on his radio. He realized that there was a problem, or that he was causing a problem. When we did the investigation into that train operator's actions, we shared our findings, which was we verified that all this occurred through the cameras on the lead car of the 7K train, through an analysis of the ATC recordings, through a playback of the Ames display, which shows the movements, through a download of the car equipment, you know, the car-borne VMS data. So with all of this analysis, we were pretty confident to determine that this was done on the part of train operator error. When we further investigated the incident, we identified that the passengers had been evacuated onto the roadbed while third rail power was still on. There was also MTPD police on the scene who were also on the tracks under the belief that power was off. There was an ARTRA supervisor who had hot-sticked prior to this occurring, and there are certain phenomenons, one of them being confirmation bias or an intentional blindness, where I believe this individual actually performed the function of touching the running rail and the third rail, which would give you a dim glow or a yellow light on a hot stick. I believe he performed the function but didn't recognize that the third rail power was on. And that belief was reinforced because at the time this occurred, when you keyed down a 7K train, after approximately anywhere from 19 to 22 minutes, those cars will go dark. So I believe this ARTRA supervisor from interviewing him said he saw the cars go dark, so he assumed that third rail power was off. At that point, he verified it by hot sticking. By all accounts and by all data available, that third rail power was on for an additional hour and 20 minutes and didn't come off to about 9:30 at night. So based upon that, there was a review of the actions done by ARTRA management of field supervision as well as individuals in Iraq, and that led to discipline of or administrative action against another five people who were involved. That investigation is still ongoing because, like Bob brought up earlier, it's discipline is not the only solution to solving red signal violations. And some of the things that I'm looking at currently are technology solutions where we can get positive stop, seeing what benefits ATO can bring when we go back to ATO down the road. Although I just want to caution everyone that ATO would have prevented this incident. ATO does not prevent every red signal violation. So that needs to be recognized. We're also looking at hours of service issues. We're looking at whether this individual or other individuals, are we screening them properly based upon their past records? We're looking at our discipline policy. Is it effective? We're looking at efficiency testing in a variety of other areas. So if anyone has any questions, I'd feel free.
Yes, thank you, Pat. There's a lot in the accident to consider, certainly. And you've described what the driver didn't do, all the things, turning off the radio. But what struck me when I started hearing about this was there anything in existence now, anything in the cabin, a checklist, a bell, a whistle, a signal, anything that would have stopped him from proceeding as he did? I realized the radio was off, but was there anything else that would have caught his attention, caused him to check himself in some way?
Well, and I know we're going to talk about the Atticus report later. One of the recommendations in the Atticus report was to come up with a sticker in the cab that gave you three distinct actions to take: verify you have a speed command, verify you have a lunar, check switch position. That sticker was in the cab, but I just want to state that the sticker actually was modified by WMATA employees to contain five actions that you're supposed to take in addition to those, and I have the sticker. I can share that with you. So that sticker was present, but a sticker does not stop the actions of human, you know, it does not intervene over human action. So it's a sticker. It's a tool. It does not stop that train operator from operating. So in my belief is the best approach to this is to come up with a technology solution, signal-based or carbon-based, where either you have true positive stop where a train operator with zero speed commands cannot move that train past a red signal, or you have another layer of protection, carbon, where if someone with zero speed commands will not move if they go forward without selecting a restricted manual mode or some other mode. That, to me, is the best solution to this problem. However, till we get there, there are other things we can do, like training, efficiency testing, you know, performance monitoring, and even if we started today, it would take quite a while to get to positive stop. So we need to do additional actions. And those are being addressed as far as training through things like route guidance, route familiarization, proper communications, handling incidents in the rock. So.
Well, I certainly agree that the automation may be the ultimate solution, but in the meantime, I think the human factors and the training and the redundancies are important to remember. Other questions? Mr. Goldman.
I do want to ask questions on the IDEXIS report, but I will do that the next round. I wanted to ask a follow-up question in your presentation on this Glenmont injury accident. So the operator went through the red signal coming out of Glenmont, and then he did a crossover on the diamond, which put him onto the track that northbound trains use. Is that correct?
That's not accurate. Okay. I may explain it clearly. He was in a northbound pocket. His normal route out of the station would have been to cross over this train and go on to a southbound. He went straight out of the station. Now, prior to him leaving the stations, about 32 seconds earlier, a northbound train came through and came into the pocket across from him. That's why the switch was in that position. When he left, he headed in the opposite direction of normal traffic on that track. So someone leaving Wheaton, it would have been a head-to-head move.
But at that switch point, at that diamond switch point, is there a second red signal there or some indicator that tells the train operator that he's going onto the track that will have northbound traffic as opposed to on the track that should have taken him in a southbound revenue direction?
The signal that tells him that is the signal leaving the station.
So it's that only red signal
right.
tells
and
that, him that.
And that is standard signal design across the country.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Lobby.
Just a couple of clarifications. You talked about the Wheaton train. You said that they're 2,000 feet away, but he would have received a reduced speed signal. Is that correct?
Correct.
Is that automatic, or does that require that operator also to take action to stop this train?
No, that would have been automatic.
It would have given him a penalty brake application
right.
before collision.
Because he would have been in ATP, which is a manual operating
yes.
mode, but his movement authority or his speed limit would have been truncated as each track circuit in front of him dropped. So that would have been automated.
Now, the train going in the wrong direction there, would that have also gotten a penalty brake application before a collision?
No.
No. Okay.
That's the problem, because he was able to go past the red signal through the switch, and he can go at 12 miles an hour until he derails or something else occurs. So there is no that's essentially the problem.
Just a comment on efficiency testing, because if just many of the things that went wrong here, such as closing the door before you have the lunar signal, I assume that you're looking at, to make sure that people are following that requirement as well as others. I know we had an incident here, but if there's one, there's probably more people that are doing that. And I guess efficiency testing is really the only way monitoring how closely the operators are adhering to all the requirements. I would assume that's the only way to do it is through the efficiency testing. Is that about right?
Yeah. Otherwise, you have an incident, and then it's surfaced through the incident.
Yeah,
just to speak on that for a moment, I spoke to Archer Management this morning, and I gave him a suggestion. It's a fairly simple efficiency test that you can do. You can coordinate with the rail control center. You can put a signal at danger leaving a station. You have the capability to monitor that platform from a station camera. Now, by rule, when a train comes in, they are not allowed to close their doors until they get a speed command, which I I was told this morning I can't quote you the rule. But so what you could do is, from an efficiency testing standpoint, is you coordinate with the ROC, you document mm-hmm. the time that that leaving signal is placed to danger, you use the camera on the platform, you have that individual come in, and if they service that station and they shut down those doors, whether they move or not, they fail that efficiency test.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to institutionalize in how you're going to perform these tests so everyone's clear.
And there's discipline associated with each one of these tests, correct?
I would assume yes. Typically, though, with speed violations, that's incremental. So if you're 5 miles above, it's generally a warning. 5 to 10 is a reprimand. Anything above 10 miles above the posted speed generally would be more severe discipline.
Thank you.
Mr. Spedberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lavin, you mentioned the operator went through two signals, approaching a couple workers. They were fortunately quick enough to get out of the way. They started screaming at the operator or the train. That operator stopped then 200 or 300 feet past that. From your investigation, was it the screams that made the operator stop, or was it something else that alerted him to stop?
I just want to clarify one thing. He went through one red signal that has two red aspects.
Okay.
But it's one signal.
Thank you.
But yes is the answer to your question. It was the two track workers on the track yelling at the train operator that finally captured his attention to stop the train. And even with that, he stopped 300 feet past them, and he's traveling at 12 miles an hour. So he traveled for, I forget the exact number of seconds, but it was a substantial amount of seconds.
And then he turned on the radio.
Correct.
I know it may sound like a silly question, but I'm curious if there was something to learn from that there, if there were something other than the scream or screams. No.
I mean, this was just a flagrant, numerous violations. I'm not really, to be completely honest, I'm not clear what the question is. I mean, there's lots of lessons.
Was it something that took place in the cabin or in his space that alerted him, oh, I've got to stop? Or was it the screams that alerted him to stop?
No, it was the screams. The individuals on the tracks, as best as we can tell, that alerted him that, you know, that there was some type of event occurring.
Ms. Hutchins.
Is there any information regarding the amount of time the operator had been working, or what his, when he came into work, or something in the correlating this accident? The question is regarding his attentiveness. Obviously, he was not attentive the entire time.
So just to give you a little background, we reviewed his hours of service. There mm-hmm. was no hours of service violations. Mm-hmm. We reviewed his training records. He was properly certified to be a train operator. We reached out to medical. There was no medical conditions that would have prohibited him from operating a train. Now, as far as from a distraction standpoint, based on the interviews, this individual was extremely concerned about getting a break. So he was inside the blockhouse arguing with the local supervision there because he wanted to take the train. He was only going to operate at two stops. At that point, he was going to be relieved by a train operator in the field, because my understanding is where he was going to be relieved is pretty, you know, there's a lot of places to eat lunch. There's a lot of restaurants. It's more desirable. That's the place to get a break. And he was actually upset because they put three intervals out ahead of him. So it got to the point where it turned into this childish debate where they kind of said, just get out of the blockhouse and go wait on the train till you get a lineup. So if anything, this employee was, you know, it wasn't this rush mentality put on him by management. If anything, this employee wanted to get out of that terminal because he was concerned about getting a break.
Yeah.
At least that's my understanding of the way the sequence of the interviews went.
he was rushing for a different reason. I said he was rushing for a different reason.
Correct.
You didn't mention that a drug test was administered, was it not?
Yes, it was, and it came back negative.
Yes, Mr. Augustine.
Thank you. From the discipline hierarchy that you would have, what would be sort of like the process? Was this employee in the process, and what is the framework of that?
Okay, so that's one of the concerns that are being surfaced by this investigation. This individual came from the bus side. He had had two red signal violations, a red light camera incidents. He had had he made a right turn on red, and this employee did not have a whole lot of time, you know, a long career. I think it was approximately a little over 2 years. At that point, he transferred out of bus, and then he went on to the rail side of the house. In that short time that he was on a rail side, which was less than a year, he had two operational infractions, and then this one being the most flagrant, which is why the administrative action was sought against him. So what I would like to do as part of this, as we investigate these incidents, is look through the vetting process and perhaps set a criteria where someone cannot transfer from bus to rail, and those problems are addressed appropriate while they're still on the bus side, rather than moving it to the rail side.
Good idea.
Thank you.
Anyone else? I guess then you can move on to the briefing on violations generally.
Yes, now we're going to talk about red signal violations.
This is your day.
Okay, so the basic definition of a red signal violation is a vehicle, train, or piece of equipment passing a signal displaying a red aspect or red light without authorization. There are multiple levels of safeguards designed into the system to ensure safe operations, but a violation of a red signal is a breach of one of the safety defenses and is without a doubt a serious lapse that has the potential to lead to catastrophic damage and to property or serious personal injury. Since 2012, there have been over 60 red signal violations. Overruns are reported to state oversight. Investigations are performed. There was a Atticus report commissioned, and corrective actions are ongoing. I just want to point out in this slide that the total for 2016 as of this morning is actually 10. So when this report was prepared, we've had two incidents since that time. The chart reflects the red signal violations recorded since 2012, broken down by year. In investigating the violations, the challenge is identifying the primary cause and thereafter developing a mitigation strategy. This is due to occurrences happening on main line and in yard at all hours of the day, night, every day of the week, both with rail cars in service and not in service, including when track equipment maintenance activities are being performed. However, two of the common themes identified are that they occurred under slow, restrictive speeds, under 12 miles an hour, and involved human error, which is a contributing factor in a majority, if not all, of the violations reported. In reviewing the data, another commonality revealed is that operators had 3 years or less of seniority. The column on the left reflects actions underway from redevelopment of train operator curriculum, including new refresher training programs, to visual reminders to safety notices and new signage, to procedural changes such as the one previously implemented by a general manager to have ROC superintendents observe the controller during special train movements. The majority of the pending actions are approved corrective actions based upon our oversight's previous findings. Actions such as schedule adjustments to allow operators more time before pullout, to comprehensive radio training, yard schematic handouts to reinforce yard familiarity and route characteristics, to train console stickers as a visual reminder to critical rules, and those critical rules are a red signal aspect means stop, verify lunar signal, get permission from terminal, check speed commands, and ensure correct switch alignment. Those are the stickers that are posted in the cab, and a signal recognition aid that operators can carry with them to review.
These actions are either in progress or scheduled to be rolled out beginning this fall for the first quarter of 2017. In addition, we are taking action to develop and implement enhanced job briefings with route maps, as well as rules and compliance testing for controllers and upgrading signal lamps with LEDs for enhanced visibility as part of SafeTrack. One of the other things, which I had a conversation this week with some of the signal people, when we're rolling out these LEDs, I'm going to try to get them to make at least one of the aspects habitually strobe, because that flashing will draw someone's attention to that when you get that type of movement, rather than just having, although it's brighter, or just a solid red. So that's something they're looking into to see if that can be done.
Before you leave this chart, could you tell me about the radio training? What's entailing? What does that entail?
The radio training is part of the problem is we lack radio discipline, or we don't have it at the sufficient level that we do. And they came out with a permanent bulletin so that when people give commands via radio, A, they're clearly understood, they're repeated back. And in areas where you have poor communication, the train operator is supposed to stop and not move the train to establish that communication. There's a permanent bulletin. If you like, I can send you that.
Okay.
Thank you.
So we will continue to implement these actions outlined here today, in addition to developing corrective actions based on collaboration with our oversight partners in an effort to mitigate this hazard. This concludes my presentation. I welcome your questions.
Mr. Dormjoe.
Thank you. So I just want to make one comment and then ask three questions. You know, the Atticus report was pretty eye-opening for me, and I'm glad that we got this out to the public, and I appreciate your honoring our request to do that. But you know, it's pretty obvious that we're not moving quickly enough. I mean, the contact with the consultants was in February of 2014. The review was done in December of 14. The preliminary report was issued in April of 15. And we haven't adopted the report in a final form to either accept, reject, or modify the recommendations. I do see, you know, that you included a matrix of actions that WMATA has taken, and it seems that there's been a flurry of activity since you've become the safety director. So, again, I encourage you to move rapidly here. This is a significant issue. So the first of my three questions, it's pretty clear that we have incomplete data on this issue. The Atticus report only covers, I believe, 12 incidents, so that's less than 20% of the incidents since 2012. There seem to be some patterns. You alluded to one of them in terms of the experience or lack of experience of the operators. I think understanding the complete picture would be helpful. Geographically, it was also clear, you know, in at least the subset in 2014, all the incidents occurred above ground. The majority of them occurred at the terminal locations or at the yards. A lot of the incidents occurred not during the rush hour. Many of the incidents occurred at the beginning or end of shifts. So I think we need to do a lot more to understand this issue, and so I would ask that you report to us in a more comprehensive manner in the future on the whole universe of red light incidents, because I think understanding what's really going on beyond an incident-by-incident kind of diagnostic is really important. Every safety system in the transportation realm relies on data analysis to evaluate and then ultimately implement positive recommendations. So what are you doing to understand the whole issue going forward?
Okay, I think Glenmont is probably the best case study of what is wrong with a red signal overrun. So from that standpoint, I'm looking at 13 different areas as far as red signal violations, to include
What is the disciplinary process? What is the vetting process? What are the technological controls we have in place? What can we do to get back to ATO to reduce these occurrences? How are we, you know, doing the efficiency testing? Is it efficient? Is it effective? I mean, I can, if you want to give me a minute, I got three folders here, but I can go through the list with you. So I recognize.
I appreciate that, but what about the issue of analyzing the data? I mean, is that happening or not?
Well, it is happening because we've invested a tremendous amount of money into an SMS program. The issue is, and I'll give you a sidebar issue to this. I'm also looking at hours of service for bus operators. So when I get that data, it tells me how many violations you have. Now, when I look at those violations, I find it difficult to gauge what that means, because if you're just telling me the number of violations, I don't know what that correlates to in the number of runs. So I had my staff now looking at that data, and based on that, I can identify which depots are having the most frequent hours of service violations. And then if I identify the depot, then I could identify what the obstacles or the challenges that depot faces. Is it a vacancy rate? Is it some type of different union environment which has different operating rules? So I intend to do the same thing with red signal overruns from that standpoint.
Okay, good. So my second question has to do with the philosophy around safety. It comes out in the report, and you may disagree with the consultants, but they seem to have a much different philosophy about safety systems than the kind of I'd say legacy management. So both of you guys are not legacy management, so I guess you can be the champions of reform. But their criticism focused on how the incidents were responded to by management. And there was a much greater emphasis on kind of discipline. All the incidents were viewed in a somewhat kind of narrow manner as rule violations, and there historically hasn't been much of an effort to understand the root causes or the systematic issues that may be going on, you know, with the culture, with the management protocols, with training. Do you accept the kind of more nuanced focus of the consultants that produced the Atticus report? Is that something that we should see more of going forward, or is there a disagreement that kind of understanding the nature of inattention and distraction and, you know, how humans behave in, you know, these circumstances, is that less important to you, more important to you, having read the Atticus report?
Okay, I can give you my personal opinion on the Atticus report. It was a well-written report, and they surfaced a lot of valid concerns. I think probably the best operational things to come out of there is that the fact that we don't have sufficient route familiarization, which is if you're driving in your car and you don't know where you're going, you're not proficient at operating. I do believe that they did. Now, having conducted accident investigations for 13 years, I think it was a little bit of an oversimplistic approach to accident investigation, where you give so much weight to this rush mentality, which I believe, yes, that is a factor, but not to the gravity of which they gave it in the report. For example, there were two incidents mentioned in the report, one of which they say the train operator, after a three-hour break, was asked by a dispatcher to jump ahead one interval to take a train out, and because of that, she felt rushed and ran a signal. In another incident, there was a train pulled into a station. When he birthed in the station, there was a train in front of him that he could see the red taillights on, and he dwelled in the station with the doors open. He waved to people he knew. He had a chat with them, and then he shut the doors, took off, ran a red signal due to the rush mentality of management forcing him to speed. So, yes, in any transit industry, there is tension and friction between operation, performance, and safety. However, I don't believe it to the extent that Atticus is giving it the weight that it's giving it. However, and also from an accident investigation standpoint, I didn't see Atticus talk any and do any holistic overview of hours of service,
your fatigue awareness programs, things that would really influence your operational performance. So I think the report had value. I just question the weight that it assigned to certain topics.
If I could also, I mean, yes, there is a change of philosophy. It is to be more, you know, comprehensive in how we're approaching this. But we're not, you know, but we are going to look at everything. So, for instance, in the case that we just talked about, you know, that is a discipline case when someone leaves a station because they want to rush for their own personal needs or whatever that is unacceptable. And, you know, we're going to do something about it. But, yes, we have to make sure that we do understand the human factor side of this and give that some attention as well.
Okay. That's a perfect answer. I'm glad that you guys responded that way. I'm very encouraged. Because I think you do need to strike a balance, and I don't think it's all, you know, it's you know, the kind of punitive approach, that kind of heavy hand of crunching down on the operator is not acceptable. But at the same time, I don't think that, you know, we can explain this away simply because there's an urgency to achieve on-time performance, so that we can. So you guys are doing what we need you to do. So my last question has to do with the issues around operations. Given that we don't have, I think, a clear timeline for the whole system getting back to automated train control, in the meantime, is there any value in thinking through ways to kind of supplement the operator in terms of possibly having a conductor on board? I know you're from the New York system, and they have a two-person crew. Is that something we should even consider? Is it a completely different system? Are there circumstances, July 4th, rush hour, where even on a trial basis, it might be a good idea to have, you know, a conductor who can handle the kind of the platform operations and announcements and monitoring the doors, and we can kind of allow the operator to focus on the movement of the train. Are there that's just one thought, but are there other operational things that we should be thinking about before we get to, you know, this state of, you know, full technological utilization of the automatic train control? What can we do in the meantime?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I don't know, and I come from New York. We get a tremendous amount of red signal overruns in New York, and that's with conductors on the train. Because typically, even those are two separate functions that the train operator performs, it's generally, even if you had a conductor do the door operation, shut down, do your platform observation, and then you had the train operator take over operation, if he's still moving with a zero speed command, then you're still going to have that signal overrun. What I would like to do is, and I agree with you, we can't wait till we get full technological implementation. I think some of the quicker strategies are to raise the conspicuity of the signals with LEDs, especially flashing LEDs. One of the other things you can look at is we had a recent signal overrun. So the train operator's cab is positioned here. The signal is on their left side or their off side. Maybe we can run a repeater signal that's, now with LED technology, the weight of the signal heads are much lighter. You can put a repeater on the train operator side. We'd have to look. I think those types of things would probably be more beneficial.
Thank you. Good answer.
Is that it? Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Goldman.
Thank you. Pat, I have one comment and two questions. I was chair of the safety committee last year. Tom Folger was the co-chair. The committee was not aware of this Atticus report, and I certainly wasn't aware of it personally as chair, and I find that very, very disheartening in a very uncomfortable position to be in, trying to run a safety committee and oversight a system where apparently documents, reports that have some value or have some probative importance to the issue being discussed are not brought to the attention of board members and board members on the particular committee. So before we began, I asked you to, if you could undertake to investigate, in addition to the safety investigations you're doing, to find out, you know, how this report was commissioned, how it never became something that the public became aware of last year, and how it is that its distribution was fairly limited within the authority. Thank you. Comments, questions. Most of the red signal violations that were the cluster of the Atticus report appear to be, as Mr. Dormjoe pointed out, either in the yards or at beginning of run or end of run stations. And I'm just wondering if that's an accurate summary of all of the, I guess it was 44 or 50 in the last 5 years, that the problem seemed to cluster in the yards and in the beginning of the runs and at the end of the runs. And I'm wondering if there's some kind of situational problems at the beginning of runs that causes this greater level or this clustering of red signal violations at that point. The implication seems to be that the train operators, once they're moving, you know, once they're on the line, once they're in revenue service, observe the red signals and operate properly consistent with all the operating guidelines, but that there seems to be some, I don't want to make too much of it, but chaotic or disorganization or lack of clear procedures at the beginning of the runs or end of runs that's causing operators to become situationally unaware or not really feel comfortable with their situation before they actually begin the run, and therefore they're focused on other things and not looking at what's the speed setting, what's the red signal violation doing, and therefore they're not totally focused on their job as they seem to be once they begin their run. And I'm just wondering whether that's an accurate assessment of the red signal violations and how you would respond to that.
I could understand why you'd have that perception of that, and I haven't done a full analysis of all 60, but in the short time I've been here, that's not been my experience. One of them occurred at a junction between stations where the train had a lineup, and then there was a failure of a track circuit. The lineup dropped out. The train operator then inadvertently runs a signal. We've had two that were occurring on the safe track movement where train operators were not, it was not their normal operational experience that they would have in a typical day, so you were under the specialized move. We had two of those. We had one at an intermediate station. We've had one in a yard, and we had one at a terminal. So I think you have to look at it two ways. You have to look at it from the individual circumstances surrounding each event and address those problems, and then you have to look at it globally to identify the trends and identify what areas we can be improving on.
So you're saying that the clustering in the stations and the yards in the Atticus report is not representative of the full grouping of red signal violations over the last 4 or 5 years?
I'm not saying that, because I'm not tying what I'm saying to you to the Atticus report.
Okay.
I'm just saying in this experience I've had since I've been here, that has not been my experience. But I haven't done the full evaluation the way Atticus has done it.
So I look forward to that full evaluation of the 44 or 50 incidents over the last 5 years. Second question, then I'll stop. One of the key recommendations of the Atticus report, as Mr. Dormjoe and you have alluded to, was this, what I call this cheat sheet, or you call a console sticker, which would sort of be in front of the train operator and tell them, well, did you check to make sure that the signal is not red, that it's green, that you can go? What happened to that recommendation? Why wasn't it adopted and put in place last year?
I believe that I don't know if I explained it clearly. There was the Atticus report came out with three items that are supposed to be on the sticker. As an agency, we expanded that to five. It is my understanding that it's at least 85% complete. The individual who was involved in the incident at Glenmont, that sticker was present in the cab.
So it is 85% complete in terms of the number
of stickers installed in consoles, but those would only be installed on A cars where you operate from.
So what you're sort of saying is that it's not the 100% solution to the problem.
I think once you have a sticker, initially it adds value. After a while, it becomes wallpaper. So you need more than a sticker.
Thank you.
Mr. Lobby.
Yeah, I took a look at the Atticus report, and I kind of like what you talked about. There's some good stuff in there, but I think you have to look and see how it applies to the operation that you have here at Washington Metro. One thing, you know, I noticed with the hours of service violations that they're not going up per se. They're not coming down. It's an ongoing issue, which to me indicates that the issue of red signal violations and probably other types of violations, such as closing the door before you have a lunar signal, that some of these issues are probably out there and need to be captured and analyzed. And when I talked about earlier, when you gave your safety report about injuries and that type of stuff, another indication of how safe an operation is how many violations you have of different rules. They don't necessarily end up in an accident, but they give you an indication of how well your operators are performing. I think the automatic train operation, I think that's something that long-term needs to be in place to do the best you can to prevent some of these incidents, but you're absolutely right that you also have to take care of the human element, because if it's not red signal violations, you know, there's other things that can happen that the human being really has to be engaged. So, again, I thought the Atticus report had some good ideas in it, but I think there's some fundamental work that needs to be done as far as making sure that there's an appreciation for the rules, there's consistent following of the rules, and I think that emphasis is probably most important right now in order to build a foundation that you can build a tough safety culture on. But right now, I don't see how you can talk about the operators being rushed and not able to do their job. I mean, there's procedures in place that need to be followed, and if those are followed, these issues should begin to go away. So, again, the Atticus report's a data point for me, but I think those recommendations, you look at them, you see if they fit or don't fit, and you react accordingly.
I'd just like to mention one other thing which I failed to mention. It speaks to Mr. Dormiso and Mr. Goldman. One of the things I have done since I've been here is we collect a tremendous amount of data through our SMS system. I reached out to FTA, and there's a specific person over there that is very familiar with, you know, all the principles of SMS and collecting data. I'm meeting with her probably in about a week and a half, and we're going to go over some strategies where we can adopt to improve our utilization of that data to start addressing some of these negative trends.
If I could just also add to that, we actually met with that particular person and a safety representative, in fact, from United Airlines, that went through how they set up their program, again, on the SMS sort of side of the house, as we start to think, you know, just much, much broader than the way that we've been doing some of the work we've been doing.
Yeah, SMS is the way to go in the future. This week, FRA is announcing their system safety rule, which is an SMS system that will be issued for all the commuter rail and passenger rail operations in the country. So everybody's going in that direction. It's a lot of expertise out there, but I think this would be fertile ground to begin to address some of these problems.
Any other questions? I see none. And I want to thank Mr. Dormjo especially for bringing the Atticus report to the attention of the committee. You did that last week and sent it out to all of us, and it was the first I'd seen of it as well. So thank you for that. I think there's one last area, and that's the update on NTSB recommendations.
Okay, so the NTSB issued, and this is just a verbal update, the NTSB issued 24 recommendations. As an organization, we've met several times internally. All of those recommendations were assigned to specific individuals that have responsibility to answer those. I believe internally our goal is to have our responses ready by August 10th so that we can give them to the GM to review to make sure we're all on the same page. And I believe the deadline that we have to submit back to the NTSB is going to be August 23rd. So that's what I have, and it's a work in progress.
And I'm glad that's on track. Good.
Are there any comments or questions about the last item? Seeing none, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second?
Thank you.
All in favor? Aye. Any opposed? Thank you. The meeting's adjourned.